Okay. Hello, everybody. I would like to introduce Marcel Hortmann. He's giving us a talk about Git and Cogito. You're working for the Red Hat security response team, and he's involved in Blues and OpenOBX. So, welcome.
Okay. Welcome, everybody. I keep this in English, even though it was originally announced in German. I said, okay, I do it normally in German, but if somebody wants it in English, then it's okay. So, anybody minds keeping this in English? Okay, fine. So basically what I'm doing in the next half hour, 40 minutes or something, I will talk about JIT and Cogito, the source code management system that was developed by Linus Torvalds for the kernel development. And this is not a technical talk. It's basically what do you need to know to deal with the kernel developers, to use it for your own. So some basic things that you need to know, especially if you used other version control systems before, so you get you started. So basic agenda is, okay, the first thing we talk about SCM models, which we have, and which is Git and Cogito following, or which other are following in basics. A little bit of history, why we have JIT. I don't would talk about the name, because nobody actually knows why it's named this way. I do some basic internals, a little bit to scare you, and then, okay, it's even easier as you think. And then we do a little bit hands-on with JIT. So what do you need to know, what to do, how can you do it, for what it's good, why you should use it, and basically how you should use it. And then I step up to Cogito, which is basically an additional front end to JIT, which makes life a little bit easier for people that are not so skilled with the JIT internals. Okay, first of all, this talk is not about the holy war of SCM. I don't care. I basically use the source code management system that fits the best for the project. So if the project uses CVS, I don't try to convince them to use anything else I try to use with this. If they use Subversion, it's fine. If they use BitKeeper, yeah, whatever. BitKeeper is another story. We'll come to that a little bit later. If they use JIT, in case of the Linux kernel, I use it. Other things are Mercurial, Monotone, and a lot of more. Anybody else, any SCM developer around, please don't get offended. There are so many of them, I don't even try to list them. This is basically the ones that I used before, so these are on the list, and there are many more. The only question is central against distributed source code management system. So basically, what you have is you have a central thing, then you have like CVS or Subversion. You have a central server somewhere that stores all your revisions. So all your changes you made to your software are stored on a central server, and you have to have an admin that administers it, and etc. The distributed is, okay, everybody has a local copy of the revision and the change logs and of everything and carries it around. So basically, everybody has its own central server, if you want to look at it this way. So general central is CVS Subversion, BitKeeper is distributed, JIT and Cogito is distributed, Mercurial and Monotone is in general also distributed, and a lot of things more. All of these are open source except for BitKeeper, which I will never mention again in this talk, anyway. Picking the right SCM. Okay, as I said, central management, it's great. You can easily do backups. You can store the complete repository in a backup and something gets away. Okay, you can put it back and you have everything. The problem is you basically have to deal with access rights, because in normal use cases we have a bunch of users that have read access. They can check out versions and can play with it. And other people have commit access, so they can change something in the repository. So you basically have to have an admin that deals with everything. And sometimes you don't even want this, because you have so many people working on it, and then new one comes, and okay, this one has to have commit right, this one doesn't have commit right, and etc. So it's some kind of problems that you have, and sometimes you have a big repository with thousands of files, and you want this guy only to be capable of changing these 10 files or something, because he doesn't have to work on the other things. It's kind of hard, because you need a lot of access control in place for central management. The distributed goes completely the other way around. Everybody has the same rights. Everybody has a local copy. Everybody has full rights on a repository. But merging this again back into one bigger repository, the guy who owns the bigger repository decides what he wants to merge back, etc. So, as said, every repository is independent, so you can work wherever you want, in a plane, on a train, in a car, or whatever. You don't need online access to really change something. With a centralized thing, okay, you need to access a server to change something. With a distributed, okay, I do something, I do my work, and then, okay, at some point, yeah, I need to sync it with another guy, and maybe that's it. So other than Kernel's workflows, it's basically this is one of the things that Linus Torvalds basically likes, and in case you have 200, 300 developers that basically work on total independent parts and like to really work independent, it's a great idea. In general, you don't have any central instance. Sometimes you want to make something public, so you have some central instance at some place, and you can see, okay, yeah, it's a central instance. But in most cases, they are really completely independent, even you have some kind of central thing. The holy war, as I mentioned, goes between, okay, our central is the best, distributed is the best, and then, okay, this version control system is better than the other one. Anyway, people try to do some shared distributed SCMs. I only want to mention that name, so you heard it before. So they're trying to combine the best of both worlds. So having a central place somewhere where you can send all your stuff, which is controlled by an administrator. Okay, this machine crashes. Please get me everything back. We have some synchronous workflow. Oh, this guy works on this. He commits it and sends it back to the server. Everybody else has it. While if you really work offline or really asynchronous, this guy might work on 10 or 20 different changes, and then at some point later you only get these back, and basically shared distributed means you get it back in time when he did this change. The big advantage of doing some kind of shared distributed is you have some kind of offline work possibilities. You don't need online access, you can do some work offline and then sync it back later. Obviously this always has problems, okay, you need to how to sync, how to get the stuff back, etc. So I have no idea how shared distributed SCM really it's going to work. But some people always try to convince me, okay, this is working, we do it this way. And they have some kind of management instance in place that keeps a track of everything. Okay, as I said, there's one name I don't mention any time more in this talk. So, what we had before JIT. We had a tool. Basically, in the early days of the Linux kernel, we don't have any source code management system at all. What we saw were patches, some pre-patches, some RC patches, once a week, once a month, and this is how you were capable of following Linus Torvalds and other developers what they were doing. Some people published their own patches, most famous Alan Cox AC patches, etc., and you can't were capable of building your own kernel along, and basically in most cases you have to wait until Linus released a new version. Oh, this will change, and maybe you saw a change log of 10 lines or maybe 20 lines or a nice email from him, okay, he changed this, and which ended up he changed every 200 files or something like this. Was not really good in following what he was doing. So with this one tool, not mentioned anymore, we got Linus Torvalds to use a source code management system and gave us immediately access to all his changes, all the changes from the other developers. So you had transparent access to all the changes and could really see, okay, he's doing this. Oh, my patch is merged. Great. I don't have to wait to check for the next version if he really merged it and move on, etc. As I said, best thing to use to get Linus used to an SCM. Okay, so the question is, why do we have JIT? Some history lesson. So, Larry McVoy, who knows his name? Yeah, come, hands up. Not even okay. He wrote this tool I never mentioned again. It was proprietary. A lot of people flamed Linus for using a non-open source tool for the kernel development. Anyway, the tool was great, no matter what. It was ahead of its time, and it really did a good job and helped a lot of people in getting their workflows done a lot faster, especially in merging changes back to the Linux kernel. There are some statistics around how many patches were merged when we started using that tool, and yeah, it was great, but it was non-open source. Okay, basically no problem. There was some kind of open source license for it where you get to use it, but you don't get the source code for it. Was fine. Problem came around when Andrew Twitchlow, name known? Hands up? Yeah, okay. Mr. Zamba. Thought, okay, I don't want to use this crazy license that this tool implies, and I simply go and reverse engineer it and write my own one. I think he called it SourcePuller, if I'm not mistaken. And the funny thing is, he basically didn't do anything wrong, actually. He simply said, okay, it has a web-accessible interface on a specific port, and you can telnet into it. So he started telnetting into this port and said, okay, help. Oh, this commands you can do. And he started synchronizing the repository and then reverse engineering the internal format, which he basically did with Zamba was the same. I think, did anybody know the story about the French cafe? how Zamba was actually developed. Okay, it's another story. I say the basic idea. So basically, you end up, if you don't speak French and you end up in Paris and sitting in a cafe, how do you really want to order? Speaking English is most times no option. So you end up, okay, listening to the guys around you, what they really do if they want to order something, so ordering some kind of pie, and you see what they get. And then you say, okay, let me try to reproduce it, telling this to the waiter or waitress, oh, I get a pie, great, I learned part of the language. And the idea goes right, okay, you need a waiter that is really nice to you, and you can hit him with a lot of bad things, so putting words together and offend the waiter or waitress and see how he reacts. If he punches you in your face, you're basically screwed. But this is how Zamba was developed, and so how Andrew got around the BitKeeper parts. Okay, we end up hitting the server with commandos and see how he reacts and trying to guess from that how it really looks like. Anyway, obviously Larry McVoy is making money with this tool, and he's not really happy about somebody reverse engineering, because he always sees this as a kind of threat to him. So he tried to sue Andrew, and in the end we ended up, okay, we don't use it anymore for the kernel source code management system. So what we ended up, I have no idea, I think Linus did it by himself after evaluating some other source code management system, locked him up 1 week in his office and started hacking on JIT, and basically this comes out of it. I think it was 1 week. Maybe some people might correct me if they know details, but I think it was 1 week, and they came up with some weird patches and a weird email and a weird explanation why this name is chosen anyway. The good thing is, because of Andrew and because of a pissed off Larry, we got JIT, and we have an open source tool, a source code management system which is really capable of dealing with a lot of changes and a lot of files. So compare how many files are inside the Linux kernel, how many changes we have. You really need a good tool to manage this. Okay. Some basics of the SCM. General view, easy view, not a detailed view, and not in a technical view. You need to store the changes. So you have a bunch of files, and you do changes to them, you change them, and you want to store these changes so you can later see on why you want to do this, and you need to store a message why you changed this. For example, this is because this Intel hardware has a really stupid bug, and we need to work around it, blah, 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 blah. And sometimes you don't want to have all this information inside the source code. There's some war about, okay, what do you really want? Oh, let's store every information inside the source code. Some people say, okay, it's great, but in the end, you have a lot of documentation or comments in your source code, and you don't only have only really small pieces of code by yourself, which is also not good. So store the not obvious ones in the source code and try the other explanations, trying to use an SCM for it to store this information. This is my religion about this. Other people might say it's different and they have different opinions on it, but basically I see, okay, let's keep the more information in the SCM and keep less information in the source code, because the source code is source. What you also need is an interface to get to these things. So you have a repository where you store a lot of files, so you need to add and remove files. You need some method to edit these things. Not mentioned here, normally use a normal editor, VI, Emacs, whatever. And then you need to commit these changes. So, oh, I have these changes, I want to make them another revision of the system. And of course, since only committing the changes doesn't help, you need to review them later on and see why you did this later on. Because if you don't care about what you did a year ago, then you don't need to see SCM at all. At some point, you will go back. Okay, let's step over to some internals. Basically, everybody knows the CVS directory from CVS, and Subversion uses .svn, and the other tool used some SCCS files, a lot of them, and basically what JIT is doing, it's storing everything under .jit in the main directory, and it's separated in basically objects, we will see that later, with another subdirectory which has the first two characters of the SHA1. And then the rest in stored directories. So basically this object directory, everything that JIT stores is put into an SHA1 file, and this file is put under objects. So basically everything you do is totally atomic, because you said, okay, I store it somewhere with an SHA1 name, except for SHA1 collisions, but there's a workaround to detect them. So basically everything you do, you change something, you add a new file, you create a branch, we come later to that, etc. Everything is atomic and stored somewhere. Basically, the objects directory is really the changes that you do and the files that you have in your directory. Then of course you have revisions for what is the current head, the current actual head, additional branches. We see that in examples later. Special tags, for example, Linux kernel 2.16, so you can easily access them. Additional info files, basically, actually this is a lowercase I. Additional information files about the repository, and one head file, which gives you the actual head of your current working tree. It gets a little bit clearer when we start working with it. Okay, let me get back to the scary commands. So, in the beginning, basically, you had to play around with SHA1 numbers a lot, checksums, so you really ended up having some weird command, ls files, cut files, and a lot of more, retree, etc., etc., which were really scary, and basically, always I needed some kind of script sheet around, okay, why I need this command, why I need this command. It was not really obviously what you want to do if you want to have to check in a new file, do a new commit, etc., etc. So basically, this Reno, I have somewhere. Shift Control Plus? Yeah, Shift Control Plus. So you list your files, and you get something like this. Ooh. See a lot of numbers, have some file names, okay, there's identifiable. If you know something about Unix internals, okay, this may be some kind of current mode of this file, etc. Way too scary. Way too scary for me. I really hated always doing this, and basically, if you're really interested in this, this is wrong talk for it. I'm not getting in more detail than this, but you see everything, every file is, has an SHA1 file, every commit message has an SHA1 file, etc., etc. So what you need is we need something better around it. So basically, let's simply try to get a new repository. So we go later on and check out the kernel repository and work with it, but we simply do something for ourselves now. Okay, let's have some, I call it new test repo. Oh, there's another thing I have to explain. The git commands are, you see both things, you see this, which is basically a wrapper around all commands, and you see this ones, which in dash in between. It's basically the same, but the tab completion is a little bit nicer if you have a minus in between. So you basically set up your repository, say, oh, this directory is my new repository, and okay, set up, defaulting to local storage, and let's put a file in there. We use the editor. Okay, quite easy. Hopefully nobody is scared with VI. I can't put up a graphical editor, this will take too much time. So, we need to add this file. Okay, edit. And since it's a new one, we changed it already. So, commit it, minus A. Another VI window. A command text, everything with dashes will be subtracted from the message, and it says what files are new. This file is new. Sometimes you will see change file. You will see that later. So that's it. Basically, you have your wrong command. I want to have this one. Oh yeah, that's it. And if you look at your directory itself, it's nothing really special. You have your file there, as you obviously have, and you have an additional directory in .git where you really store your changes. So let me edit this again. In this case, modified, as you see. Yeah. Wrong one. And another commit, and the file is obviously always the latest one. Okay, oh yeah, the git status, sorry. Sometimes you want to see the status of the repository. So in this case, it says nothing to commit. So we need another one. then I see, okay, what file is modified? Actually, the message when you see when you call commit. Really easy. So far, anybody scared? I don't think so, right? Everybody who worked with another SCM, it's kind of straightforward. Okay, the git diff should I also mention. Okay, since this is not committed, you can also make a diff. Okay, what's really changed in this directory, which is a great future. And it's all offline. Even if I'm connected to the internet, this is all offline because it's all on your local system. And you can do whatever you want, change things, diff it, see what you changed, and then decide, okay, what you want to commit actually. Okay, really easy. If anybody has any problems, raise your hands and ask your questions in between. Don't wait until the end. More interesting is if you really want to do some additional work. So basically, what you just saw is, okay, I do my changes, I commit them so I can go back in time and want to have check what I did and see why I did it and what I changed, etc., etc. The git branching is really nice if you want to play with some testing. So you have, okay, I have this current changes, I want to play with something, but I don't want to use my main branch or my master branch, as is named in JIT. And I simply create another branch and play with it, and then, okay, yeah, no, this works, I know, then I can go back. So basically what you do, branch lists you the branches, the mark with the star is the actual one. Now you see you have two branches, but you still follow the master branch, and then you need to check out this branch, and if you then look at it, okay, it's now following the master branch. The same file is in there, so we need to add this here. It also tells you know on which branch you're actually working, so it's an experimental branch, you always see this. Okay. The README is now this, and you know what you do, you can you check out the master, and then you see this line is now missing because it's not there anymore. And you can switch back to the experimental, and then you have the other file. And as you see, it's really fast. And even if you play with a kernel source directory which has whatever kind of number of files, then you get it easy. Okay, maybe the fast is not really comparable because we only have one file in it. But if you once start playing it with a Linux kernel and you have enough memory, you will see that it's compared to other source code management systems really fast, and compare how many files the Linux kernel really have if you deal with it. Okay. What you can also do, okay, let me get back to the master branch. You can, of course, pull the changes back in from the experimental. If you say, okay, the changes I did were great, they worked. Okay, let me get to the back to the master. And you see even the master has the complete change there. An additional command, if you don't need an the branch anymore because you only try to test something and you say, okay, this is not working out, I don't want to follow this branch anymore, minus D simply deletes it. Also really simple, really nice. Yes, please.
Will it delete all the information from the branch so that even the change logs I made there are gone, or are the change logs still somewhere?
That's a good question. I think it will change it. The wraparounds will delete it completely. But there are some low-level tools where you only delete the branch and then the files are still there and you have to clean them afterwards. In general, it deletes the wrapper, delete everything around it, so it's gone. Why do you want to keep them?
For the history.
Yeah, but if you think they are worth keeping, then you merge them back.
Yeah.
Yes. Sorry, I should have showed this. So you have the additional one from the experimental branch over there, where you have the additional commit message. Okay, simply it's an easy thing to work on something, play with something, and then get rid of it because it's not working out. If you think it's worth keeping, you don't want to delete it, no matter what. Then you merge it back, and even if you change, only the change logs are worth keeping, then you extract them or you simply merge it back and keep them. If you did something really wrong, for example, you broke the complete system or rewrote it, that's another story. Besides these branches, which are all in the same repository, so they're all available via one directory, you can clone your directories, you can create copies of it. Basically, it's interesting if the other thing is only read-only, only available via HTTP, or you don't have any commit access, etc. So basically, what you do is you clone your directory. So we clone the new test repo to my repo. And now you have a complete additional repository on your own. Both repositories are now, the my repo and the new test repo, are complete independent. So every change you do in the my repo will never commit it to any files under new test repo, except you want to create something like shared repositories, which I never got the really use for it, but it's possible to do so if you want to. So what you also can do, I think we simply add a new file. Okay, another file. Oops. So in the my repo, we have now the file authors. Oops, wrong keyboard layout. And if you go to back to new test repo, you see you don't have the file authors. So basically, people can really walk independent. If you have a network in between on a different file system or wherever, or shared over the internet, whatever, they can really work independent. And the interesting is, okay, we can also now get it back, so you can tell something, okay, please pull me in these other changes. And it starts pulling them in, and we have the file there, which is basically a basic idea behind distributed source code management system. So you let some people work completely independent, and then you pull it in. And as long as they don't interfere too much, you can don't have any problems with the automatic pulling, because they will merge the changes as needed. The pulling automatically commits the information and adds it. If you only wanted to see what the other guys were doing, then you can do something like fetch and have the remote repository, and then you create, add it to the master, to the head, and create another branch so you can see what's been done in this branch. And okay, that's fine. I check out now the master, and then I pull the branch in there. So what we've seen in the previous slide really goes for this, and you can copy it in and see, okay, this other guy did this, especially if you don't trust them, for example. Some guy comes, okay, I have this done incredible changes, and please put them in here at the URL where you can find them. Okay, say, oh, whoa, what I do with this? Okay, I look at the data. I fetch them, create a new branch for it, and see what is he really changed, and what is he doing, and what files he touched, etc., etc. Say, okay, that's fine. He did a good thing, and then you say, okay, I pull this in. And in this case, you would destroy the test because you only git branch minus D because you don't need this information anymore. Okay, as I said, one other good thing is, or another important thing is, you need to really look at the history, what you have done, what you have changed, especially if, last year I changed something. How was this patch? How did I this patch? And basically, there are some naming conventions you see in JIT. I mentioned that already. You have the head, uppercase head, which is basically always the top of the directory, and not top of the directory, top of the repository. And yeah, then you have, I have no idea, what is this called in English? It's a hyphen? Garrett. I can't remember this one. You have the head, which is the actual last commit, and this is the previous commit. And you can also do something, okay, the previous of the previous one, and this means, okay, you have five of these, and then you can shortcut it with a tilde and then the five. You can also use branch names. So if you have the experimental branch there, you see, okay, what really have changed? The diff means source code change, like the diff tool. What has changed between the head and the experimental branch? And then you can say, oh, yeah, I look at it. And another thing is what you really have, you can tag different states. In this case, you tag the head, which is the active string, with the special name, v1.0, version 1.0, and then this tag stays forever into this head, and you can simply branch from this head, and you can even use a diff name for it, and wherever you want, actually. And you can always reset your repository to this specific tag. Okay, we have a strange change inside the repository, and I need to test something, or I need to do a backport for an older kernel or whatever. Okay, yeah, please go back to 2.6.12 or something, and then go from there on, and then we work on it. Really great. You don't have to copy it, you don't have to clone it, you simply can reset it. And if you go reset to head, then you are back to the state you left it. Okay, so far, no questions? Okay, what I said, basically, I didn't go into details, but everything is stored in SHA-1 files, everything, and everything is stored uncompressed, basically. Or this was the original idea. And this, of course, if you store every change of the file, the complete file, not only the changes, the complete file, the new revision, it is fast, but it also takes space on your hard drive. So I think the original calculation was we had, if you import the complete Linux source code from 2.4 from the tool, from the other tool, and then make it available, it would be something around 2.8 gigabyte of data only in the .git directory, which is not actually okay. The Linux kernel itself, I think it's unpacked, it's whatever, 500 MB or something. I have no idea that much, but it's kind of a lot of big size unpacked. Do anybody know what it is, 200, 300 MB unpacked, the source files? It's kind of big. And then you have 3.8 gigabyte or whatever it was. Okay, first one, okay, you might have a hard drive for this. They are not so expensive, but somehow you have to sync it from the internet, and you don't want to sync 3.8 gigabyte. So at some point they decide, okay, we need to compress the repository or the metadata of the repository somehow. And basically you do this with git repack, minus all, minus d, delete the previous non-used any ones, and then you can clean up with git prune. Since we have now our nice repositories, we go now in the git directory and I simply call a find, and you see a lot of objects now here. Basically in all these object files that you see here, there are the information about the changes, about the source itself, etc., etc. And if you have a lot of them, and the Linux kernel itself has a huge amount of them, you end up with a lot of files and consuming a lot of space. So basically what you want to do is git repack, oops, minus A minus D. Oh, okay, my bad. And you want to pack it. And then you want to prune your directory to clean it up. And now you see an additional thing that is called pack, which has also an SHA-1 number, but it's stored on a different directory. And basically this pack contains everything from the previous SHA-1 directories compressed and packed with delta compression into one big directory, one bigger file. And you can have a lot of these packs and really simply save hard drive space and simply save band-wise if you have to transmit this to another machine. There's a general rule that you should do a repack every 4 to 5 megabyte of changes. That's a good sum of rule. I personally prefer, if I do a new release, then I repack the complete repository, and that's fine. I think even Linus, in most cases, he follows it. So every time he announces a new kernel, he repacks everything, so you get a small pack. And small is still something around 120 megabyte big. And if you look at the history kernel. Oops. You have packed, you have it 266 megabyte. And our current, I think it's up to date as of yesterday or something, is 145 megabytes. So you you add these both numbers and you end up something, what is it? 411 or so. You end up with 411 megabyte of packed or compressed metadata only to store the revision of the Linux kernel, which still can fit on a CD. CD, what's the name for it? Medium, CD medium. So it's okay compared to 3.8 gigabyte or even more. It's okay, and you can transfer it in some over normal DSL lines, etc. Okay, so the question is why Cogito exists. First, the name basically, I don't really got why they really got this name, but they needed something to wrap around the initial JIT commands. What you saw in the last slides were kind of easy. You have git add, git commit, git log, git status, etc., etc. They are kind of easy, but it wasn't that easy in the early days. So they said, okay, we need something to wrap around. I don't want to deal with SHA-1 numbers are all around. I don't want to update the index. I don't want to update the tree. And all the weird things you had to do in the early days. So the Cogito project started. And basically it's a name. Why the O is in behind, I have no idea. Co help git, why the O comes from, it sounded nice or something. So the shortcut for Cogito is CG. And basically was simply to make JIT usable from people that were used to CVS, were used to the other tool, were used to Subversion or etc. And in the early days, it basically was always a small little shell script that wrapped everything around. And it made it possible for even a non-experienced user to switch to using JIT as an underlying repository and really use it for daily use. The commands are kind of identical. You have CG init. It's like git in a database, CG clone, like JIT clone. Oh, another one. I hate OpenOffice for doing this. Anyway, CG update, if you want to update your data from a remote repository that you cloned, you cannot do diff, and you can use it minus R, and then you can put origin. It's one of the word origin things that Cogito introduced. Between the origin and the head, so between these ones, you make a diff between them, and minus R, like from, you know from CVS. CG add a new file, even CG remove, etc. CG commit, to simply make a commit, and you get another front end for it, and we'll see it later. CG log, the same as with the same parameters as CG diff. Log me against, give me a log about the origins. Oh, thank you. Yeah, there was something when they used that name. And why do they wanted this word? Have any idea? I don't was that much thinking about it, but anyway. Okay, let's create another one. Okay, now you see the difference with JIT init DB. It only creates the database. The Cogito also, okay, the creating the database is the first commit. So we have something initial commit. And it's like CVS, everything that is prefixed with CG will stop. I will extract it from the commit message. So basically, you can simply save this. And then you have your first commit already with no files. If you have test GZ2. Blah, 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 blah. And then you run a CG init. And you commit it. It also already uses every file that's in there already. So you can simply unpack, for example, a tarball, call CG init, and everything that is in a tarball gets you to the state you want to use. You still see the SHA-1 numbers here for this commit, for example. In general, you don't need them, but in some cases, you want to have some really strange differs, you might want to need them. And the same thing, okay, we need another file. Oops. You add this file, you commit it, no minus A option or something, and the lines are getting a little more detailed, so you see what you have modified. Basically, the A stands for edited, or M for modified, etc., etc. And then you can have, okay, and, whatever. And then you see your another commit. Another commit message. And you can go on it. I personally think CG or Cogito is more easy to use than JIT itself. And I only found a few rare cases where I really need to use some special JIT commands to do the work. I personally love Cogito and really like because it's easy and you can do everything you want with it. The nice thing, what I found really helpful, it's only a small thing, the highlighting, the color highlighting is that you see is kind of nice to see things really fast. Let me add some changes here. And the nice thing is they even do it for the diffs. So you call CG diff and you see, okay, yeah, this has changed. And you see the green lines are edited and you can even remove the lines. And I really like it and it's really helpful. Okay, the status is a little bit different. Basically tells you what the master branch is and the files you have modified, mreadme. I think it's easier to read than most of the JIT commands, but that's only my opinion. With Cogito, you also have the brancher thing. In this case, it's not called branch, it's called CG switch. You basically you switch between branches. And to create a new branch, you need the minus R, and then you call the experimental. And then you can see on which branch you're on. Let me just do this. Experimental. Why is he not doing this? Yeah, but I want to create it. Okay. Maybe I got this wrong. So, you tell them where to start, where you want to create this branch on. And now you see it switch to the experimental branch, and you have the file there. Okay, I need to correct my slides. You can do the same as we saw with the branches with JIT, you switch between the branches simply calling this. Another thing that I find really useful is the CGMK patch command. Because, okay, I have these changes that I made, and I want to put them out in a nice format, especially for mailing them to Linus or mailing them to anybody else. So you end up in having the commit message on top. It tells you the details of commit, who committed it, when committed it, etc., etc. It also includes a diff start, which is also nice because you see what was really changed. And if you don't care about the rest because, oh, this guy changes something in another subsystem that I don't care about it. If he wants to do this, I simply merge it. He knows what he's doing and you trust him. Then you don't have to read any further. Hallo? Okay. Ich hab's nur halb verstanden. I think it wasn't for me. Okay, anyway, let's continue. It's kind of strange. You see, I think I switched to the. If you do it inside the kernel repository, I think it's more clear. I hope we have a nice, nice change in this. Oh yeah, this is kind of nice. So basically, you also see the common patch format that you use inside the Linux kernel. So basically, if you do the, this is a complete commit message until the three dashes, and then you have okay one liner that describes it, a more detailed description, and the obviously signed off lines who really worked on it. Then the commit details itself, the commit SHA1, the tree, the parent, not really important. Who changed it? Who really worked on this patch? Should normally, in most cases, match the first signed off line. It must not always be, but is so. In most cases, the date. And then who committed it? In this case, okay, this guy sent it to Linus and Linus committed it. You have the diff start, okay, he changed this file. It's really nice to see. And then you have the complete diff of the change. I find this really, really helpful, and JIT can do something similar by itself, but I personally prefer the CGMK patch format because you can extract it and then send it off, and it even looks nice, and sometimes even store these patches for later use or when I did some changes, and all information are there. The other way around is if you want to put a patch into the repository, use CGPatch. It doesn't really pass nicely the format of mkpatch, so basically you need to play a little bit around, and maybe at some point I'll simply send in a patch that really can use the mkpatch format and put it back exactly the same thing into the repository. Okay, what we all did now was basically local stuff, and since you wanted to work with people on the outside and want to publish your repository, okay, I worked on this great project, here are all my changes, so you may want to have a look at it, etc., etc. You need to have something set up on some remote server. And basically, what I found out, it's the easiest way. There are so many tools around that wraps it, and basically you simply create an over HTTP accessible directory, which you can access via SSH. Create this directories in there. Important thing is create this initial head link. It's an old thing from the early days of JIT, where everything was stored in head instead of some sane files under REST heads master. Then you put an additional description into it so everybody can see what is the repository about, main Linux kernel tree or whatever. And then you simply can use CG push with the protocol JIT plus SSH and push it back there, and then it's available for everybody. Really nice and simple, helps a lot. The funny thing is, so far, this is all basically that I needed in most cases and what I deal with when I have worked with it. There are only a lot of special cases, a lot of tools, special tools called bisect, where you can track down a really awful or a bad change in the repository by starting at point A and starting at point B and getting in between and find the really bad thing, and a lot of other things, even different merge strategies for merging repositories if they really have conflicts, etc., etc. It's a lot of stuff. It's way too much for this talk. It's basically get you started with JIT and don't get afraid of it. Basically, everything is command line. I hope this scares nobody, but we have some nice tools, the JIT web, we would see, and also JIT K, so I will start with JIT K. And I think we first use it on the normal kernel tree. I think it's TickleTK based, if I'm not mistaken. And it takes some time because complete repository wasn't in my inode cache so far. You see basically the master and origin, which is basically the same at this time, and then you see the different streams or the different branches people worked on nicely presented over there and the patches there. And you can click on this one, what it's doing. I think it's not really good readable, but I have no idea how to get this bigger. Maybe. Does anybody know how to get the font size bigger? Yeah, no. I'm not hacking TickleTK in this course, in this talk. You basically can click on one commit and then you get the files they changed and what they changed in a nice viewable window. It's really great if you simply want to track something down where they changed something and okay, let's see what they really did there. And okay, yeah. Let me simply try what I messed up lately. Okay. You can always give a file there, and that only displays the commits for this file then, which is inside the Linux kernel really helpful because you don't want to have all whatever 30,000 files or whatever that they are current. And then you see my changes. You also see that this repository started with 2.612 minus RC2. Everything else before is inside the history tree. And basically, this is a simple line, what my changes, and you see the people who changed it, and you can basically click on this, and you get the nice files that are touched. Even if I only looked at this, at the HIUSB C file, this commit touches the other one, so it also displays the other one, and it highlights the changes, and you can simply fast and easily see what was changed, etc., etc. I think you maybe want to have to try this by yourself and see how it really works, because I think it's not really readable. It isn't, right? I can see good on my screen, but I think it's not really that good quality. And I have to change the font somehow. Okay. As previous recommendation, I should use a history tree for showing how weird the merges between the different branches and between different repositories can really get. And here you see something like this. I have no idea if you really want to analyze it at some point, but you see the kernel goes really weird ways. I think it's even, you see, well, how many parallel lines do we have in this, 12 or something? And it it's getting even more crazy at some points. It's kind of hard to find the right. I have no idea what they did at this time, and I don't want to know. But Wojtek was involved. No, anyway, it's a really nice tool. The graph itself, the project grows really big. The graph itself, it's kind of hard to really work with. I think at some point in the future, we will see even better graph tools to really display the history of a repository, since JIT and Cogito got really used, and people say, okay, that's great, we want to use it. I think lately, Xorg switched to using JIT, so there are a lot of projects that think, okay, we might want to use this tool because it's a nice thing, and it works really good. So I hope the internet connection works here. A really important link is the JIT web page, another nice project written by Kai Sievers, which you basically is, I think it's a one-file Perl script that you, a CGI Perl script that you have somewhere, and you can, okay, display me a list of all the repositories available. And so in this case, we pick the upstream kernel. There. Where's my, oh, there it is. And then you have a nice view. Okay, he changed this, etc., etc. It's current master. And someone wanted credits in his file. Let's take a look at it. It displays basically the same thing that you see with JITlog or CGlog. And you can also view the diff and see what they actually changed. And the really good thing is you simply have this URL, and this URL contains the commit ID, and you can simply point at it and say, okay, write an email, okay, please look at this change that was done at that and that time, and simply send it via email, and people can simply click on it and see what they changed without starting any additional tool or getting through it, trying to find it. It's really great. I really like it, and it's really useful, and I used it a lot lately for finding, yeah, okay, we got lucky. They disconnected me. No idea why, anyway. Okay. I think there are some more tools that are based on JIT and what they are doing. This is the stuff that I use. As simple as that. I think I'm running a little bit out of time. I thought I was a little bit faster. So basically, there's another thing. It's basically my personal workflow. So in general, I clone the upstream Linux kernel to get myself. If you clone it, you can use this kind of URL, so simply use HTTP kernel org and then the address, all nicely explained on the kernel.org website, and I have a clone. This clone is a simple copy of what is current in the mainline kernel, and you can run a CG update to see, okay, if anything changed. Since I got my internet connection back, let me see if there's real. Oh, he changed something. So basically you end up, okay, yeah, please give me all the new information from this repository. And this is one of the repositories I have always lying around. I never touch it. I don't do any commits in there. I don't do any changes. I don't do any file editing, etc. It's a simple copy of what Linus is currently working on so that I have a reference, and I can carry this reference around me if I don't have internet access, etc., etc. The other thing you saw before is a history tree for really old changes before 2.6.12 RC2. So if I really need to go back in time and see changes that was for a 2.4 kernel or an early 2.6 kernel, this is a history. I never have to update the history tree because they don't do any changes in there. So what you know, see, okay, the tree changed. It now takes a little bit longer, as you see, to commit all these changes. That's the reason because there are a lot of more fight there, but still kind of fast. And you see we have 321 new objects, and okay, what did they actually did, what they worked on? He merged some kind of PowerPC stuff, whatever. This is another thing why I really like CGlog. You see the files that are merged in blue over there. Then you see a commit message and additional information. So you can really see what this commit really touches, which is kind of hard with the JIT low-level commands. A lot of merges. Let me do some actual work. Oh, yeah, here we see the what we looked at the JIT web, the credits file. Okay, file credits was touched. This is a commit message, signed offline, and author is Linus Torvalds in this case. The second thing is then that I always, since this, I never touched this local copy of this Linux tree, but I have to work somehow, so basically I create a clone of this kernel in most cases a work clone where I simply work on it. I think I have some uncommitted changes. Let me have a look. I should have done this before, then it would be really fast and amazing, and we left it. I need some take some time to get the complete into the complete repository into the inode cache, and if I do it again, you see it's obviously a lot of faster. And we have some files that are never touched, and the source code management knows anything about it. Basically, some old directories from some early merges, some files I'm working on, and some files that are changed, modified. So what I can also do is I call cgdiff and see, okay, what I was really working on and which is not mainline, and you see some stuff like this and really changes. So this is basically, I do the working, and if I think, okay, this is ready, then I do a commit and start testing it. So basically, what I sometimes do, okay, I need to test some weird things. Okay, let me get an test repository. See how fast it really is. So we need to clone the complete kernel Linux tree, and I want to apply some patches, compile them, test them, and work with it. As you see, there are a lot of objects in there. And as I described, Linux normally uses one big pack and some additional patches. I think this is not the best day to demonstrate this, but since you had a lot of changes that are not packed, if you really work with packs, then it's a lot faster. And no, it should try to build the tree. What it's now doing, it's once it has all the objects and the packs are copied, it needs to check out these. So it basically has to check out something around 200 whatever megabyte, and now it retrieves the additional tags. I find this some kind of annoying because basically you don't need the additional tags on a local copy. In most cases, sometimes it's nice. So you get the tags. It stops something 16 or 17 something 7 RC. Blop. And now it checks out your branch, and you see. And some seconds later, you will see the. You have a nice little copy. It's not as fast as I expected it. It's a laptop machine. Okay. In this case, it's a complete copy. It's not using hard links. I think you can make it using hard links. In the initial time, there was a lot of discussion of using hard links or not. Somebody maybe correct me if it's still using hard links. I think it's simply copying. I know, I'm pretty sure for Cogito it's copying. Maybe you can, the JIT core tools, you can tell them, okay, please only use hard links. In general, you can even store both clones in the same shared repository. I normally don't use it. Okay, basically, we have now the perfect clone of this repository, and I can now apply patches and work on it, and get everything done, test it, work on it, etc. And once I'm done, I have my number of patches, say 10 or whatever, and I say, okay, these are great, these are good, this is well tested, etc., and I need to get them back. So basically, I normally do another clone, something upstream, or for upstream or something like this. Oh, okay. I only have one or two additional slides. And then I apply my patches there, and then I push it online, and then say, okay, Linus, please pull on this directory, and then he goes, okay, takes it over and pulls it in. Okay, since my time is up, almost at the end, additional documentation are in the JIT and Cogito tarballs itself, and the JIT documentation and Cogito documentation, similar to the Linux kernel itself. And you find a lot of useful links. You find also some nice short tutorials on the internet where you really get you started and get using to it. Every tool has a man page. That's a really good thing with JIT and Cogito. You have a man page. You can call man cgadd or cgbranch, as you've seen before when I messed the command up, and you can simply reference in it. They are not full of documentation, but they get you started and see what you did wrong, as in my case. And so, now my time is up. I don't have really time for questions, but since the next speaker is only in half an hour or so, if you have some questions, we can have 1 or 2 minutes questions, and then, okay. In case of a merge conflict.
Please repeat the question.
Okay, he asked, what happens in case of a merge conflict? Otherwise, please try to hand around the microphones. In case of a merge conflict, you can't obviously don't create the new branch, and you basically pull your changes in because all changes are atomic because they have a different SHA-1 number, and then you have to start to change it by yourself. Okay, this merges. Okay, I can resolve it somehow manually, and then you can commit it afterwards, as you would do with CVS or with other things. JIT has some different merge strategies, which is basically out of limit for this talk because it's a simply basic talk. You can say, okay, try to merge it this way, try to merge it this way. The most common known is three-way merge. They had some weird discussion on the JIT mailing list at some point where they really were, okay, well, this is the best merge strategy ever and whatever. I don't want to get into this discussion what's best. If you're lucky, it works out. If you're not lucky, you have to do the work by yourself, since most times the computer can't help you if it doesn't know what to do, especially if collisions in between. So, as in CVS, it will not commit your changes. It will. You can pull the changes in. You have to resolve the changes by yourself that are colliding, and then you commit this additional change to resolve the merge, and then you're gone, as you did with CVS, you know, CVS and subversion and whatever tool. Conflict is always a problem. There was another question. Yes, please.
Does JIT or Cogito support or even are they capable of enforcing workflow, a mandatory workflow? That means that I can define certain actions that have to be performed before, while, or during a submitting of a command, for example, commit or pull or something else, so that there, for example, tests are performed that have to be passed before I can commit some code.
It doesn't enforce a workflow, but what you can have is what they call hooks. So you can have some additional scripts that use some checks, and then you can, okay, this commit method doesn't pass our standard format, and then you fail the commit, and so you have to fix it. Yes, you can have this.
Okay, thank
you. Yes, please.
Can you move the file from one directory to another?
Oh, you, okay, yes. The question was, can you move the file from one directory to another one? You mean because CVS you can't move files around, and Subversion can do it somehow. In general, you can do this in simply removing one file and adding to another one, and the commit will automatically detect a move or rename. So it's some kind of automatic detection, because there was an endless discussion if you really want to have a special feature to move a file from one place to another one, or rename it or whatever. Basically, what they finally did was they do automatic detection if you have a renamed file or a moved file. So it's supported, but you don't see it actually. You do, okay, remove this one, add another one, and then it even looks like removing it and adding another one because it's not otherwise possible if you use a diff to display the changes. But the intelligence behind it simply detects, okay, this is a rename, or this, you move this from one directory to another one. And it also can tell you, okay, these files, are one is deleted and the other one is added, and they're quite similar, and they tell you some kind of 90% similar or something. So you can get an idea what was changed. But it's not an explicit move command. It's an add and remove and then an internal check, because add and remove were always problems. Does that answer your question? Another one, please.
Does JIT support versions of directories? It means which kind or which number of files are in this directory in version 1, and perhaps there exists a version 2 of the directories, two files more, and I can switch between the versions.
I don't fully understand the question, what you want to do with it. Basically, the directory is it's not really existence. It's only a part of the file name, actually. What is your use case for this?
I'm developing a project, and in the first release, I only have small features, and I only need three files in the directory. And the second release is much more powerful, more features, and so I have to add more files. And yes. I want to switch between the releases, and I want to look in the directory and see which kind and which number of files are existent in the first release and the second release. And so,
yeah, you can. You simply you can with branches. You can set back in time, and then okay. You run a find command and see the number of files in there. Or run the CG status with additional options. Okay, these are my files, my repositories. So you get number of files in version A and number of files in version B, and then you have to do the rest by yourself, because the tool doesn't really help you because it's not the written for this purpose. Another question? Then I'm only 6 minutes over time. Oh, one another?
Can I merge some repositories? For example, if I have a couple.
Okay, thanks for your attention. Thanks for staying 6 minutes longer and enjoy your lunch break.